The RPG After Years is part of the We Can Make This Work Probably Network. Find out more at probablywork.com.
Welcome to the RPG After Years, your weekly show covering all things RPGs from the past, present, and future. I'm Scott. With me today is my fiance.
I'm Corey.
This is episode 64. We're here today for a review episode. We're going to be reviewing the long-awaited 2018 Sega Tactical RPG sequel,
Valkyria Chronicles 4.
Feel inspired, like I'm ready to go to war. Since it's a review, we won't be doing any catch-up or anything like that. Today we're going to be covering the development history, and we plan to cover the first half of the story of the game. We'll see how far we get. We'll cover the rest of the story, the gameplay, and our final ratings in part two. But before that, just so we don't fall too far behind, here are a couple quick show updates. First off, for those who are participating in the RPG Club with us, we are currently playing World of Final Fantasy, and the current checkpoint is to complete Chapter 20 by tomorrow, which is, what is tomorrow? May?
The 9th, I think.
May 9th, yes. So go ahead.
Also, I think tomorrow's Mother's Day. Must not forget that.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it was this Sunday or next.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, the RPG Club is a sort of like a book club where the RPG After Years community, we all play through the same game. It's sort of at the same pace, going through certain chunks of the game at a time. It's a good time. And after this section, we only have one more section left. Like the next goalpost is to beat the game. So that's going to be exciting. Corey, you haven't really had a space to give your thoughts on World of Final Fantasy. Got any quick opinions?
Yeah, there's a special spot in hell for whoever wrote the dialogue.
That's it.
That's it. that's the standout feature for me.
I remember you liked the game a lot more at first than you do now, but
it's I feel like it's starting to drag a little bit. I feel like the tail end is starting to get a little weak.
Well, I feel like that's true. Well, I'll save it for tomorrow when I record the RPG Club with Rich, because that will also be later on in the episode. So look forward to that. So I guess the real checkpoint for those that are listening to this live is to beat the game by Sunday, May, what's 2 weeks from now? Let me look at the calendar, May 23rd. So yeah. Another quick announcement, the Materia Lockdown is ongoing. That is our charity event where all proceeds go to the Motor Neuron Disease Association, a cause close to Bill's heart. It's basically a challenge where a Twitter bot assigns your Final Fantasy VII characters certain colors of materia they're allowed to use. It makes for a pretty fun way to like remix the game and get through it an old classic in a new way, if that makes sense. And it's for a good cause, like I said. So that ends June 26th. So I encourage everyone that hasn't already started to jump in on the fun. You can find out more at materialockdown.com. And follow the bot on Twitter at FF7MLD.
And for this week, a little bit of news for RPGs that were released in the past week. We only have one really of mention, and it's called The Hand of Merlin. It was released on PC, and it was on May 11th, which is actually just early access.
Yep. And as far as RPGs coming out in this coming week, we got Mass Effect Legendary Edition on May 14th. That's coming to PS4. Xbox One and PC. I'm excited.
They're still making Mass Effect games?
This is a remaster of the first trilogy, which I'm actually kind of want to play because I've never played one.
I kind of want to play a Mass Effect, see if I like it.
Yeah, for sure. I plan on buying that. I don't know if I will on release, but anyway. And then also, here's a title, Void TRRLM parentheses semicolon plus plus / Void Terrarium plus plus.
Whoever works for marketing in that company needs fired.
That's coming to PS5 on May 18th. And that's all the announcements we have. So let's jump right into the review.
Squad E, move out.
That's our transition noise for this.
Good old Squad E.
Okay. So again, we're just covering the history in this first part of the story today. Valkyria Chronicles 4 was first released on March 21st, 2018, in Japan only. That was 1,145 days ago, or 3 years, 1 month, and 18 days. But we don't really care so much about Japan. We really just care about the US and the UK. The worldwide release was on not only PS4, but Nintendo Switch as well, I believe. So that happened on September 25th, 2018. Which is only 957 days ago, or 2 years, 7 months, and 14 days. How long? We played this like early to middle of last year, right? Ourselves?
It's been a little while, yeah.
Yeah. I have an oath that I've made to review every game that I beat on this show. And because Valkyria Chronicles 4 is an RPG, it kind of got left behind because just we have to plan around other people's, Rich's and Jay's schedules, as well as just what other episodes we want to do besides reviews. And it just kind of, our RPG reviews fell by the wayside as far as games that only Corey and I played together. But hopefully we'll rectify that because I plan on making all of the episodes that fall into my lap reviews for the next little while. So on this show, we always go over the what music and movies were at the top of the charts at the time of release. In the US, the number one release was In My Feelings by Drake. Gotta be real with you. Yeah. Kiki, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you and I need you. And I'm down for you always, KB. Do you love me? Are you sound familiar, Corey?
Nope.
It should. It was the number one on the last review we did as well. Which was with Lauren, Life is Strange 2, I believe.
The next one I recognize. I didn't recognize this one.
Well, we only reviewed it last week. But if you want to hear more of our thoughts about that, you can just go into the Patreon under Life is Strange 2 review. Basically, it's an okay song. And then winner of the song that has been featured on this show the most often, because apparently a bunch of cool games came out while this was number one, is in the UK, it was the number one was Promises by Calvin Harris and Sam Smith. I made no promises, I can't do golden rings, but I'll give you everything. Magic is in the air, there ain't no silence here, so come get your everything. What about this song, Corey?
I've only listened to it a couple times, but I like it.
It's okay. I feel like Calvin Harris and Sam Smith have better options, so I don't know. It's an okay song. I just don't understand why it was the number one for so long.
Maybe it was like their first one or something.
Maybe. Okay, do you want to do the movies?
Sure. So in the U.S., the number one at the box office, back when we could all go to theaters, was the 2018 version of Halloween, which was directed by David Gordon Green, and the main star, the leading actress was Jamie Lee Curtis.
Because wasn't she the main actress in the original Halloween as well?
I think so.
But now she's old.
With her she's still great, though.
Her Yoplait and shit.
She's still great.
Have you seen the Halloween 2018 version?
Yeah, I've seen all the Halloweens.
I don't think I've seen that one.
I'm a fan of all of the Halloween franchise.
I know I've seen the original, but...
Anyway. It's a good one. We should watch it.
Add it to the list.
Yeah. In the UK, the number one at the box office was... shit, we just talked about this one last week as well, I believe. The House with a Clock in Its Walls, directed by Eli Roth, starring Jack Black, Kate Blanchett, and Owen Vaccaro.
Yep, and neither of us have seen this movie, but it's one that we wouldn't mind catching at some point just because of, you know, Jack Black and Kate Blanchett.
Correct. And I remember it being previewed and remember thinking I want to watch it.
Right. But that's what was going on in the world of pop culture at the time. So I guess we'll just launch right into history.
All right. So starting off, Valkyria Chronicles 4 is a tactical role-playing game developed and published by Sega with assistance from MediaVision. It was released in Japan for the PS4 and later worldwide for the PS4, Xbox One, Nintendo Switch, and Microsoft Windows. It was also ported to Stadia in December 2020, as if people actually play on the Stadia.
Google got that Google money, just put everything on there.
Yeah.
I feel like there was some other game that we've reviewed that MediaVision had a hand in, but I don't know what it was. I want to say it was Grandia, but I'm not totally sure about that.
I'm sure there was a couple.
All right. Before starting in on VC4's history specifically, I wanted to talk about like the series inception, like how it came to be in the first place, because there wasn't a whole lot of information about Valkyria Chronicles 4 specifically, but Valkyria Chronicles 1 and 4 take place in the same world. There's a couple crossover characters, and they sort of like, they're basically the same game, just, you know, different stories, different casts, and some gameplay differences. So I thought we'd go back and see how the series got created. The earliest concept for Valkyria Chronicles was created in 2003 during discussions between Shuntaro Tanaka and producer Ryotaro Nonaka. The two were part of neighboring teams working on different games. Nonaka was leading production on Nightshade, while Tanaka was completing the GameCube port of Skies of Arcadia, which is a game I haven't played that I've always wanted to. The two wanted to work on something new, with Tanaka suggesting a game based around a dramatic war story. Both had worked on the Sakura Wars series, but knew that they would face restrictions if they created something within that series, so they created a new concept. Nonaka and Tanaka later said that the similarities to Sakura Wars are mainly because of shared development teams and gameplay styles, rather than conscious choices. A key aspect of the project was to go against market trends, which were focusing on specific genre archetypes that did allow for much creativity on the team's part. Its final Japanese title represented the focus on war, with the term Valkyria symbolizing its fantasy elements. Maybe they shouldn't have gone so far against the genre archetypes. I don't know if I've told you this before, Corey, but the series has always struggled with sales.
Valkyria Chronicles?
Yep. Also, I don't know anything about Sakura Wars, so...
Neither do I. In the game's earliest form, the gameplay was a traditional tactical simulation game played from an overhead view. After considering this, Nonaka, comparing it to a game of shogi, realized players would feel little emotional investment in characters if they continued with this gameplay style. The concept of the Blitz battle system was to encourage player freedom. When creating the battle system around firearms rather than swords and magic, the team needed to abandon many of the logical RPG standards. The team chose to have players control individual units to further emphasize the game's themes. The AP system was designed around the concept of emulating the fear of soldiers in combat, afraid to take a step in case of hidden enemies or making a fatal move. The class-based leveling was a response to the large number of playable characters. If they went with traditional character-based leveling, the team knew players would likely stick to a few favorites. They wanted players to get emotionally invested by picking party members based on personality, making their loss in battle more noticeable. A sixth character class, the medic, was originally planned, but was eventually relegated to the downed unit rescue mechanic.
Do you feel like they succeeded in making you care about the soldiers when you lost them?
Depending on how long you'd been playing with them, yes.
Yeah.
Because there were certain characters I didn't want to lose.
Right. I should say that Corey and I have also played Valkyria Chronicles 1 in the past, so the gameplay was nothing new to us for the most part. And I looked it up. MediaVision, other than Valkyria Chronicles, is mostly known for Wild Arms, So, which is weird because I'm not a big fan of Wild Arms, and I do really like these Valkyrie games. Anyway, the world's period setting, based on Europe during the period before and during World War II, during the 1930s and 40s, was in place from the beginning of development. The aim was to blend the setting with medieval elements, with the rest of the worldview and design springing from that point. The country of Gallia drew inspiration from smaller countries at the time, like Belgium and the Netherlands, which were often caught between larger powers. The team considered using Switzerland as an inspiration, but its mountainous terrain made tank combat impractical, so the team based it primarily on the Netherlands. The Empire and Federation were respectively based on Germany and the United Kingdom during the 1930s. I feel like this is like pretty obvious even when playing the game. It's like, okay, it's supposed to be that country.
it's definitely made obvious.
To give the story a more personal feeling and draw from Japanese military history, the characters were made militiamen without extensive military training, creating a deliberate contrast to the hardened career soldier protagonist from the movie Saving Private Ryan and other military video game series. The Valkyria formed an allegory for weapons of mass destruction and real-life conflicts. I had that idea, too. I was like, this is basically their nukes.
Yeah. The overall visual design was influenced by the long-running anime series World Masterpiece Theater. As part of their research on the graphical style, the team researched both realistic and comic-based art styles. The uniforms were based around a variety of real-life uniforms, with both practical elements and individual quirks that would not be allowed in real life. Originally directly inspired by World War II uniforms, they looked too futuristic for the setting. The team instead drew inspiration from earlier uniform designs, which were more specific to different countries. They also made an effort to keep American uniform influences out of the designs. The Imperial tank designs were based on those from the Russian military.
Thinking about how their uniforms are, I don't know if like that was super common. I guess that would make sense because we're so used to seeing the American uniforms. And so I guess these uniforms wouldn't be so familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
The game made use of a proprietary game engine dubbed Canvas, which produced stylized graphics modeled on watercolor paintings. Nanaka wanted to blend traditional animation style with CGI elements, something he had previously experienced with the Neo CGI used in Sakura Wars 3. Canvas came about from experiments within another of Sega's R&D department, with next-generation engine technology. Its graphical style, which allowed for the emulation of hand-drawn artwork, was picked by staff once the game was moved to the PS3. I thought this was really interesting because one thing that's really cool about the game is its art style. Like, it's very anime, and it does almost look hand-drawn the entire time.
Agree.
The drawback of that, which we'll get to in graphics, is they don't do a whole lot of full-motion cutscenes. It's always just, like, the characters' heads talking, kind of. Anyway.
Oh, I thought you still had a sentence to go. The game was produced by Kale Mikami, who was involved in the production of Valkyria Revolution and directed by Koo Yamashita. The game's soundtrack was written by series composer Hitoshi Sakamoto, with the main theme, Light Up My Life, being composed by, is that Shiloh?
I guess.
Shiloh? And written and performed by Mai Kuraki.
Yep. So moving on to VC4 now that we've got the series and how it all came together out of the way. The development of Valkyria Chronicles 4 began around the end of 2015, after Yamashita had finished planning the project. From the start, the developers had the goal to build a worldwide audience for the Valkyria Chronicles series, with the concept of returning to the style of the original Valkyria Chronicles game, while building upon developments from later games in the series. Whereas the PlayStation Portable game, Valkyria Chronicles 2, had been developed specifically with a Japanese audience in mind due to the popularity of the platform in that region, with fantastical characters and a school setting, Valkyria Chronicles 4 used a more grounded military setting with characters intended to feel like real people. So, yeah, we didn't play 2 and 3 because those games only came out. A, they never came out in America, although there are fan translations, but B, they were on the PSP. So I was very excited when Valkyria Chronicles 4 was announced to be back on the consoles.
And it played just almost like identical to the first one.
Yep.
In preparation for the game, the development team studied records of World War II troops and used them as reference material. As part of the project, the developers began with developing Valkyria Chronicles Remastered for the PS4 to allow players to experience the main series gameplay on a modern platform. Mikami states the game touches on what was happening to the rest of Europa during the war.
Right. So Whereas the first game featured your cast of characters trying to defend Galia from the Empire, this game has your characters actually trying to infiltrate the Empire. Mm-hmm. So that was a really cool, like, different take on it, I guess. So this seems as good a time as any for my voice actor corner. You guys know that I like doing some research into the voice actors and seeing who else they played that we might be familiar with. The weird thing is this game has sort of a ensemble cast, I would say. And so although there is a main character, it's like I could go on and on about all the other characters and who they voiced. So I'm only going to do Claude and then maybe some of the highlights from the other characters. So Claude Wallace, the main protagonist, is voiced by Max Mittleman, who's a pretty well-known voice actor. Some of his other recognizable roles are Saitama and One Punch Man, Spider-Man in the 2017 Spider-Man animated series, Ryuji in Persona 5, Kira in Mobile Suit Gundam Seed, Meruem in Hunter x Hunter, Lion-O in the Thundercats Roar series, King in the Seven Deadly Sins, Leo, Forrest, and Kaden in Fire Emblem Fates, McBurn and Lechter in Trails of Cold Steel 2, Lushu in Kingdom Hearts, Shigure in Tales of Berseria, Red 13 in the Final Fantasy VII Remake, and Philbo in Bugsnax.
That's quite a range of voice, because if you think of how, like, Red 13 is like this super deep gravelly voice, Claude is just kind of like a younger, quote-unquote, normal voice, and then Ryuji's like a very high-pitched voice.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, so moving on. Like I said, I'm only going to like maybe bring up some ones that you might recognize, Corey. Greg Chun, the voice of Raz. He voices Adam in Nier Automata. Rosh in Radiant Historia. Alphen in Octopath Traveler. Ike in Smash Brothers Ultimate. Scotch, he was one of Don Corneo's announcers in the tournament in the Final Fantasy VII Remake. Ujimi and Takeshi in Ghost of Tsushima, which we haven't played, but I want to at some point. Brandon told me it was really good. Erica Mendez, the voice of Lena / Kai. That's a whole plot point. she voiced Sailor Uranus in the latest Sailor Moon series. Pac-Man in Pac-Man and the Ghostly Adventures. Moving on, looking down here, Rixia, Trails of Cold Steel 2. Eleanor in Tales of Berseria, Eruka in Radiant Historia, Bernadetta in Fire Emblem Three Houses.
Hey.
The weirdo that everybody loves. the Great Fairy Terra in Hyrule Warriors Age of Calamity. I'm not sure which one is Terra, but yeah. So Kaylee Millis, the voice of Riley, she didn't have a lot of her, surprisingly, I mean, she is the female lead, but she didn't have a whole lot of recognizable credits. Rosine and Mint in Trails of Cold Steel 2. Chris Hackney, the voice of Miles, your tank mechanic. He also voiced Gohan in Dragon Ball Super.
He was Dimitri in Fire Emblem Three Houses.
Yep, one of the main characters. And then Alexis Tipton, the voice of Minerva. She was the Squad F leader. She voices Pearl Faye in the Ace Attorney anime. Erasa, Gotenks, and the West Supreme Kai in Dragon Ball Z Kai and Super. Hope in Xenoblade Chronicles X. Pascal in Nier Automata.
That's interesting.
That's a very different voice. Although I guess they are... I can see that now that I think about it. But yeah, that's about it for voice actor. Like I said, I was like, how deep do I want to go on this? Because we could be here all day. There's several major characters that I didn't even look at.
To promote the game's release in Japan, Sony released limited edition PlayStation 4 consoles themed around the game. Several DLC episodes were also released, and maybe we should try those at some point.
I forgot there was DLC, but there's like several episodes we didn't even like touch.
Valkyria Chronicles 4 received generally favorable reviews. During its initial March release on PS4, the game sold 77,000 physical copies within its first 3 weeks in Japan. After its release on the Switch in September, the game sold 6,000 physical copies within its first week in Japan. In June 2020, it was revealed by Sega that the game had sold over 1 million copies worldwide on all platforms. It was nominated for Best Strategy Game at the Game Awards of 2018, but it lost to Into the Breach. Valkyria Chronicles 4 currently sits in an average of 83% on review aggregate site Metacritic.
Do you think our score will end up higher or lower?
I don't know. Probably right around there, I would think.
We'll see.
Well, I guess we'll see when we get there.
Yep. Next episode. What do you think about that limited edition PS4? I put a screenshot in the dock there.
Cool enough, but I wouldn't want it.
Yeah, me either. I'm surprised they went that far, to be honest, for this series. That's about all I could find on the history, which, you know, was a fair amount, to be fair. Ready to move on to the story?
Yeah.
Okay. Story time.
That music takes me back.
That was like the main regular battle theme. Yeah. The music in this game is generally pretty good. So Corey and I might struggle a little bit with this because, like I said, it was over a year ago when we beat this game.
Oh, there's no might to it. It's going to be a struggle.
I mean, we're only covering the first part, so I'm going to be like ad-libbing this a little bit. So basically, the game starts in media res, as in like in the middle of things, with Squad E, which is our main cast of characters. They are on their way to infiltrate the Empire. While the Empire is fighting, you know, the Federation that they're from, Gallia, they've been sent on a mission to like infiltrate and basically get under the Empire's skin, not skin, but like behind enemy lines, basically, and sabotage them. I forget the exact details of like what exactly they're trying to do, if I'm being honest. And like I said, I couldn't find a super good plot summary. But the main character is Claude Wallace, who has amazing hair. I wish I could do that. Very attractive anime character. And he has joined. He is the captain of Squad E. And the other main characters in Squad E are Raz, who's like this really brash, like almost bro character. Really forward, and then also Kai, who is a sniper, and she's like this very like no nonsense, like mess with me and I'll kick your ass type chick, but she's also like sweet. However, there's some weirdness where like her name is not actually Kai, it's Lena, and we'll find out more about that later. It's a whole subplot. And then there's also Riley, who it apparently moved away from their home village at some point, but her dad used to own like the apple factory there, like some kind of factory that was important. And so she like gets back and she's like wondering what happened with the gang and stuff. And there's an ongoing subplot as well with apparently Claude used to be a coward when he was a kid, and they call him like Scaredy Claude a lot. And the whole game, he's like trying to prove himself, which I thought it was interesting because it got kind of annoying once we were like, you know, 2/3 into the end of the game and some characters are still calling him Scaredy Claude sometimes. It's like, this dude has done everything perfect the entire game.
We've blown shit up.
Yeah, he's a great squad leader. So yeah, that's basically your main characters. There's also Miles, who is your tank mechanic. He's just kind of like a sweet kid, I guess you could say. But yeah, so that's the basic setup. So they're wanting, this is during the Second European War. The Empire is trying to take over Gallia, which is a small country between two bigger countries. And their hometown was attacked at some point. I think this happens. There's a flashback towards the beginning of the game. So they're like looking to avenge their hometown being attacked. And Oh, their hometown was actually called Hoffen, which is what they named their tank after. So basically, you do learn that there was another Kai who it was just kind of, he disappeared at some point, and you sort of gather that the female Kai, who is his sister, like, took his place. But you don't find out why or the details about that till way, way later, like halfway into the game. So you go through this whole montage of them going through after the first introduction battle. You know, there's a montage where they pass their squad, their boot camp training, and they become part of the Elite Ranger Corps. And Quad gets assigned the command of Squad E. And so I know that they're heading towards the battle of Siegwald. You remember the Siegwald line? It was like a 3-part battle. That was like a really cool part of the game.
I mean, the name is familiar, but the actual details, no.
Yeah.
So at this point, Squad E is told that the Empire now has the upper hand once they captured, you know, a large amount of Federation territory. Also while initiating an invasion of Gallia. So Federation leaders decide to put all of their resources into this new task called Operation Northern Cross, which is a massive offensive with the objective to of pushing straight to the imperial capital of Schwarzgrad. So the operation is initially successful, with Squad E managing to push through the imperial territory. But along the way, they're joined by another childhood friend, Riley Miller. And Riley is initially very mistrustful of Claude due to him running away from a fire that in turn killed Riley's family because the factory caught fire or something. But she eventually accepts his command when he proves to be a good leader.
Yeah. And there's a whole subplot as well with like we were talking about, where Raz doesn't trust Claude either. But like by the time we join, you know, in the middle of things, it's like Claude and Raz are best friends, kind of like he earned his respect at some point. I'm looking at the chapter list here because I know some things are being skipped over in this summary. But there's also a woman named Minerva who apparently like rose along the ranks along with Claude. And she kind of sees him as like her rival. And she's the leader of Squad F. And it's like every time she disagrees with Claude, their commander is like, no, I agree with Claude, which really steams her panties. she's one of my favorite characters, though. And there's like a whole subplot with her as well, like learning to work together with Claude and accept him. But she's like kind of a rival character at the beginning. I know at one point you stop at a town in the Federation that seems initially accepting. And then like when, as they're leaving the town, the, like a shopkeeper that helped them, they find him like hung on a post nearby.
Yeah.
That was like a really kind of shocking scene. And then there's a part where you, have a mock battle with Squad F in that same city, I believe.
It's like, yeah. Cause it's over like resources or something, like Squad F's buying all the resources before we can or something.
Oh yeah. That's exactly what it was. And Minerva also has like this flunky chick named Crystal that she's really close with. And honestly, it kind of almost seems like based on how they talk to each other that Corey made this joke, but it kind of felt like it was implied that they were a couple.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Secret lover.
They were.
Let's see. I know you also meet Dan at some point, who is like the commander of your second tank, which is just a smaller tank. I forget what it's called exactly.
I called it useless.
Yeah, it got blown up pretty easy. Let's see, what else? Let's see. Liberation of Rain, Rangers in the Battle of Siegwall. So eventually
Rangers in the Storms was a cool chapter because they introduced weather elements while during battle. So like the rain like lowered your visibility, but you could be a lot louder without the enemies hearing you. So your tank like wouldn't trigger any actions until it was much closer to the enemies. And there was like a lightning element at one point where like it was like cross, you know, make sure the lightning doesn't flash when you cross the bridge or something.
Yeah. And I think there's also a plot point around here where they think everything's going to be okay because winter is not due. The Empire is in like the north. It's like the Russia of this world. And they think they're going to be okay because the winter is not supposed to come for a long time. But as they're leaving this city, it's like, snow, like Winter shouldn't be here yet. Like it came a couple months early or something like that.
Winter is coming.
And so that also introduces like battles where your field of vision is limited by like snowstorms and shit like that. So eventually you get to the Battle of Siegwall Line. And I think if I remember right, the idea is that by breaking that, that's like the Empire's last line of defense before they will get basically to the capital city. They won't be able to protect it after that. And so this introduces like a it's like a 3 or 4 part battle. And it's a really cool part of the game because it almost feels like it's supposed to be like the final battle of the game.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Short Squad's final line of defense. And along the way, you also battle an elite Imperial tank unit called Ausbruch, which is led by Klaus Valls, who considers Claude a worthy rival. And this guy is like, he's a piece of work. He's just very flamboyant, and he like considers... he basically considered war battles like a romantic dance.
And he kept calling Claude his soulmate.
Yes. I forgot about that actually. So he's like,
every time he's like, oh, my soulmate's here.
Yeah. He sort of like marks Claude as like his worthy opponent. And like, he can't, he's like one of us is going to die. Like I will not allow one to continue living or something like that.
But every time we beat him, he's always like, he says like, I'm so glad my soulmate survived. And that way we can meet again and do this dance all over again.
Yeah. He turns out
he romanticizes the whole war thing.
I remember you had a hard time with this that first time you fight, you have to battle him.
Oh, he's brutal.
Yeah.
That tank's massive too, though.
And spoiler alert, like he ends up, even though he's on, you know, the enemy's side, he ends up being like sort of a good guy character in the end, more or less.
Kind of, yeah, in a way.
So basically this halts the unprepared Federation forces. They sort of get decimated. So, you know, crippled by the snow and the cold and weakened by, you know, their stretched supply lines because of the winter weather is like keeping them from getting the supplies they normally would. The Federation forces are quickly routed by like a massive Imperial counterattack, and Squaddy is forced to like flee to the coast. So during this part, you have to like go through the mountains and like sort of just escape the Empire as their forces are chasing you. I remember there's like one battle where you can go two different ways along like the mountainous cliffs, then you got to get your tanks through there, and it's kind of tricky.
They did that a lot in this game, giving you they did a lot of battles where you could choose which path you wanted to go. And a lot of times it was even more than two. There'd be 3 or 4 like different paths you could take. And each path had its own like set of enemies that you would have to deal with. So you kind of had to figure out which route best matched your team while being able to protect your tanks like at all times.
Yep, for sure. So at one point, I think they find, while they're trying to escape, Squad E finds like an enemy base that they decide to take out, even though they weren't ordered to, because they think if they can take out this base that they won't be able to pursue the Federation forces any further. So they decide to do that, and they are successful. But by the time they catch up to the rest of the forces, they find that like basically everybody that was ahead of them got fucked by like the Empire laid like an ambush waiting for them to come out the other side of the mountains. And basically all of Squad F was destroyed except for Minerva. And she's like heartbroken because Crystal is dead, and Minerva like blames it all on Claude. Cause he wasn't, you know, his squad wasn't where they were supposed to be when they were needed. Which is like, it's like a really like heavy scene, this part.
Mm-hmm.
And then like basically they're pinned. It kind of looks like all hope is lost, but then the Federation Navy comes in with these massive warships that they're like huge, and they're like snow piercers kind of, where they're able to sail even through, you know, frozen ice. Like that's really,
yeah, impressive. These are boss ass bitches.
Wow. I just saw that the chat has been active over here. We got realness. And, so this is roughly the halfway part of the story. What were your general impressions so far?
I remember liking it and thinking that they did a better job on this story than on the original.
That's interesting because I liked the first game story more. And I was kind of expecting to not like this game's story as much as I ended up liking it, because I'd been told that the story was a letdown in comparison to the first one. By the end of it, I was like, by this point, I was hooked on the story. And I kind of felt like it was about equal, if not, maybe not better, but like close to the quality of the first story.
I'm trying to remember the name of those snow cruisers. They have a name, but I can't remember it.
All I remember is that the main one is called the Centurion.
Centurion. That's right. There was Centurion, and then because they only had like two of them, because they wanted like to protect them at all costs. And I remember when the one got sank, they like basically were in tears.
Well, we do remember that the three of, I think there's three of them. The Centurion's the biggest one, but we remember that they're like powered by Valkyria, kind of. So
yeah.
And then, well, I think we will have more next time to say about the gameplay, because it is such a unique system and there's lots of different facets. Mm-hmm. And you were the one that played the game. I've never actually played one of these, I don't think. I might have done like one or two battles for you at some point or tried it. But
well, if some strategy RPG comes along, I'm going to play it.
For sure. All right, so let's move on to the RPG Club.
Hey folks, my name is Brett and I'm one of the hosts of Skeleton House, an audio-only Let's Play podcast where my two friends Jess...
What is happening? Oh my god!
...and Steve...
Even he looks spooked.
...play through video games, and I edit them, add context, and act as your eyeballs. Also, we have a cat. Come check us out at skeletonhouse.budsprout.com or look up Skeleton House on your favorite podcast app. Or your least favorite podcast app. I'm not here to tell you how to live your life.
Squad E, move out!
Okay, gang, Corey has stepped away for the moment, and we have brought Rich in. Corey just didn't want to be around him and see him, so.
Yeah. Hello.
How are you today, Rich?
I am fantastic. I'm missing my boy Corey, but, you know, it is what it is. So, you don't want to be around me, whatever.
I would have just made it to where you came in the middle of the show or something, like, so we could all three discuss this, but.
Yes.
Oh, well. Yeah, I guess are you ready to, you did make the checkpoint, right?
I did. Screw you, Frost, I think, as the person said, is Rich going to make it? I was like, yeah, I'm going to make it. Jeez, I have yet failed. Wait, I failed once.
Yeah.
I have not failed since.
Okay, well, ready to convene the club then?
Let's do this.
All right, everyone, quiet down. All rise. We're here today to bring to order the next session of the RPG Club. All in favor? All opposed? And looks like the ayes have it. Then let the RPG Club commence!
All right, so this section of the RPG Club covers chapters 18 through 20 of World of Final Fantasy. And so chapter 18 was Besaid and the Sunken Temple. Chapter 19 was the Crystal Tower. And then chapter 20 was the cutscene dump, basically. So overall, how did you feel about this section, Rich? Just broad strokes.
I don't know. So that's just my thought. Okay. Yes, chapter 20 was a big cutscene dump. It's still not really grabbing me with the story of it. It's still just kind of like, hey, we're still walking. We're still trying to get these keys. We don't really know what's going on. You know, people seem to be coming after us.
The story is definitely backloaded. I think one of our feedbacks this week says something along the lines of, too bad this story wasn't foreshadowed or brought up at all until now.
Yeah.
They're telling it in the ninth inning here.
Yeah.
Which is, who writes these scripts like that? Like, there's no reason a bunch of this shit couldn't have been introduced a little earlier.
I don't know. Maybe, like, what happens if on the storyboards in the creative room of Square Enix, somebody knocked the board over and all the cards fell. So they don't know where to put them. And somebody's like, you know what, just scramble up. It's like, don't say anything. He's coming. Let's say the big director of the game is an asshole, and he fires people a lot. So maybe they just scrammed it together and said, he's not going to notice. Yeah. Like, don't. We don't want to lose nobody. So, right. Yeah, that's probably why.
I did enjoy the story part of chapter 20, but like it again, it's too little too late, really. I feel like they could have had something like, there's no reason Alan couldn't have been revealed and introduced earlier and have been like a side antagonist. And well, we'll just get there when we get to chapter 20.
I do like the anime cutscenes. I do. Those are cool. Done nicely. Mm-hmm. So anyways,
I would almost, I think we've said this before, but I would almost like a full anime of this game.
Yeah, that'd be good, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd do a better job of making the story interesting if they had to do that. So,
well, yeah.
Okay, so we'll just jump in here, starting off on chapter 18, which is titled "The Fell Spell and the Quacho Queen." So they've just gotten back from all that shit with the train graveyard in Tometown, and they've told that the next key is in Besaid, which I was excited to visit because, you know, Besaid, Final Fantasy X, that's like my favorite location in Final Fantasy.
Yeah, I figured you all would like that. Like, I knew Corey would be kind of excited about seeing Port Besaid.
Yeah. So you meet up with the Cactuar conductor, who he takes you on a train, which is like a straight up vertical rail through an underwater area. There's an anime cutscene. And I think one of the twins makes a comment like, why is all transportation in Grimoire like this? Just fucking insanely fast and crazy.
Yes.
And you get to Port Besaid, which at first I was a little disappointed by, because I'm like, this place doesn't really look anything like the Besaid I know from 10. But then I kind of got the idea, maybe this is what Besaid would be eventually if, you know, Sin wasn't blowing it up all the time. So that's in my new headcanon.
Probably.
So you're tasked with finding out about the key in the sunken temple, and you have to like talk to a bunch of villagers, and they like, everybody knows about the sunken temple, but apparently nobody's ever been there. And then you meet up with the village shaman, quote unquote, who turns out to be Shantotto from Final Fantasy XI. Now, Rich, I have not played Final Fantasy XI, but Shantotto is always the character they use in these spinoff games to represent XI. And I really like her. I think she's awesome.
Yeah, she's a beast.
Speaking in rhymes, and apparently she's uber powerful. And yet she's just a small little Taru Taru. I think if I ever do play 11, I'm going to start out in Windurst as a black mage, maybe, because I know that you get more Shantotto early on in the story if you do that.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Like a mentor or something. Anyway. So she's kind of like, they ask her to give them a way to get down to the sunken temple. And so she like curses Lon to where he can't breathe above water. Like, he can only breathe in water. And Rain's like, what the fuck? And then Shantotto gets pissed because she's like, oh, I helped you. And now you're upset. And then you have a quick little boss battle with her. And she, of course, kicks Rain's ass.
Like, it was no contest. It was just a lightning bolt and I was dead.
Yeah, frightening lightning.
Yeah, I was like, okay, that's cool. Thank you.
I love how she speaks in rhymes too. It's very funny to me, and her laugh—it's very iconic. Anyway, so Rain wakes up. They're on the beach in like these barrels that are filled with water. So apparently, Rain and Lon have both been cursed. And so, this is where you get introduced to Tidus, and Shantotto like tasks him with taking, like, being their guide down to the sunken temple. And he sort of does blitzball kicks to like get the barrels into the water.
Yeah.
So you go through this little segment where you have to like swim down to the temple. It's literally just swimming while they sort of do an expo dump. Tidus tells you that Shantotto won't reverse the curse unless they bring her a Quacho ruby, which is apparently shed by the Quacho Queen once every 10 years. And so the throughput of this section is like Lon and Tama are super interested in getting this ruby and being rich. And Rain's like, guys, don't forget, we're here for the key, too. So the main dungeon in this part is the Sunken Temple. It basically works just like any other dungeon, except for they have like these walls that you can climb up that are covered with seaweed. There's a bunch of like Quachos in here and water-based enemies. Quachos being the penguin, the little penguin mirages.
Little guys.
What do you think about this dungeon, Rich?
The dungeon was okay. It definitely was a bigger dungeon than I thought it was going to be. Same. But yeah,
I feel like it took me forever to get through.
Yeah. Once I figured out like, okay, I've got two of those gimme guys. I knew what to look for. And on my way to them, I actually picked those things up like without even realizing it. So It wasn't too much of a challenge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're pretty straightforward. The dungeons aren't like, you don't have to go off a beaten path. Like it's still pretty one big hallway, I think.
Corey was really bitching about this segment of the game because he kept saying, I thought these RPG club segments were supposed to be 5 hours. And like the Sunken Temple probably took us like that long. And then,
oh my God,
we're going to get to the Crystal Tower, but that's a super long dungeon. anyway, so eventually you do find the Quacho Queen, who hates men for some reason, and also Lon, because Lon is a man.
Yep.
And then so you end up getting in a battle with her. And I didn't really get like what the Quacho Queen was supposed to be. Like, I get it's like an evolved penguin lady, but like, what the fuck? Like, where did they come up with this idea? Why did it?
I don't know.
It's like, couldn't it have been like a Final Fantasy character, or could it have been like a monster that's more recognizable? I don't know. So you fight her, and then she gets all butt hurt that you are mean to her, and she actually she cries, and you get one of her ruby tears. And then she runs off with the Quachos because apparently something has been stolen from her by some Tonberry bandits. And so you follow her like into this underwater cave, and she like tries to fight the Tonberry King, who is like this giant Tonberry who's in like a royal cloak and a crown and everything. Very cute. And then of course Lon saves her, and then you fight the boss of this chapter is the Tonberry King and his Tonberries. Did you have any issues with this boss?
Not at all. I basically just steamrolled him.
Yeah, same here. It was a fun fight, though, I thought. Or I like the design of the Tonberry King, I should say.
Oh, yeah. He had a nice little crown.
So
robes.
After this, the Quacho Queen's like, "Hmm, I didn't need your help anyway," and runs off. I'm wondering if she's going to show back up at some point.
Probably not.
I know you can get her as a mirage, but... So back on land, Shintoto, of course, reverses the curse. There's a line somewhere in there about like Tita says something like, I'm not messing with Shintoto. Like,
yeah, he's like, I'm not crossing her.
Yeah. So you have all four keys and everything's looking good. And then Yuna arrives and she's like pissed at Lon and Rain because she has heard about how all the summoners have been kidnapped, Rydia and Aiko. And she thinks that Lon and Rain have something to do with it. Why is Yuna so suspicious of us in this game? Because she was mad at us the first time you saw her, too.
I can't remember.
She doesn't act like Yuna very much in this game.
Nope. Very strong-willed.
Yeah. So, Tidus meets her, and they get close, and they're trying to figure out what happened. And almost immediately, the plumed knight zooms in out of nowhere and kidnaps Yuna. So, it's like, well, that didn't last long, did it?
No, very quickly pick, you know, hello, snatch, yoink.
So Tita says he's going to go rescue her. He runs off. And then now that they have all four keys, like this rainbow staircase appears and it's supposed to go to the Crystal Tower. There's like a scene here where Rain's like very reluctant to keep going because she feels like they're playing into like some preordained fate that might end up bad for them. The Crimson Prophecy and all that. Spoiler alert. She's right.
Yep.
And Lon's like, well, what the hell are we going to do? Like, we can't just give up. And so then she decides to go along anyway. And they proceed onward. And that's that chapter.
Very exciting chapter. I don't know. Did you catch the famous laugh at the very beginning when you first
you
get
brought
to
that
point,
up.
Point
I was
to
so
say.
Happy that they did that.
I heard it. I immediately cringed. I was like, motherfuckers.
They know.
Mm. It popped up and I was like, really? We had to do that. We had to put that in there.
That may be the best moment in the game so far.
Yep, right there. All right. So with chapter 19, we come to the other Nine Wood Hills. So if you notice when you first get there, it actually looks like Nine Wood Hills, but very run down. It's a different version of Nine Wood Hills. They don't really allude to the reason why there's another one.
I had that same thought. Like, I was like, is this the grimoire version of Nine Wood Hills? Like, or maybe Nine Wood Hills is when before it was destroyed and frozen in time, like they keep saying. But it's not explicitly said, that's for sure.
Yeah, they gloss over that. That'd be nice to know. So you get up there to the alternate Nine Wood Hills to enter the Crystal Tower. They are stopped by Terra. As you guys know, Terra is Final Fantasy VI. She's doing her little weird flashy glow thing on top of a Magitek armor. So she's not, I don't think she's in control. She definitely didn't seem like it. She was telling you to stop and, you know, don't do this and things like that. She's summoned
to how at the beginning of six, she was controlled by that slave crown.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like we never get any Terra in this game without a slave crown. So it literally could have been any summoner from the game.
Yeah, exactly. So she summons Madun.
Madwin,
which
I guess.
Madwin, which is basically Ifrit, right? But with a hat.
Yeah. In six, Madwin was her dad. So.
Oh, cool. So it's Ifrit with a hat.
Esper, half human.
That's right. I forgot. You actually then fight her and you beat her. Did you have any trouble with her?
Not at all. I think Corey played this part and it was close.
So yeah, I mean that it wasn't too bad of a fight. I steamroll them. I'm like pretty leveled up. She falls unconscious and the twins walk into the tower. So this is where it also pops up that you've knocked her out. So I don't know if she was meant to stay there, if she was in hiding and trying to blocking people from getting to the tower, because all of a sudden that golden mask knight shows up and takes her. So if they were working to get her, if they already were in control of Terra, they would already had her. So this leads me to believe that she was there on some other orders, basically.
Yeah, I didn't get that either, because I was like, okay, why is she not under her own power? Because it's not like she actually has the crown on or anything.
No. So confusing. No plot hole.
It's like they felt that they had to have the main character of six in there, but
another summoner, I guess. Yeah. So the twins they go up the tower. This one was a pain in the ass.
It was a long ass dungeon.
Yeah. You have to just basically go up. Then you get to the top. Once you get through all the other mirages and things like that, you get to the top and you come across the barrier. So I had a little issue with this one because it didn't tell me exactly where to go at first. And I saw these two crystals sitting off the sides there. So I was like, okay, what do? I entered one of them. I was like, crap, why would I go back down the tower? And then I realized that I saw something big down there. Like, oh, I have to go fight that. And then I fight that one to release the two sword barriers off one side. Then you go to the other side and fight that. It's like wind, earth, and fire, and water, I think is what it was.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
One of them shadow or something. I don't know.
So you have to, none of it's important.
Yeah.
So you do that and you pull back to the top. The big cut scene shows up where those swords pop out of that deal. They pop out of the stone and they take the gate down. And then you go through the big old gate there and you're at the top, which looks to be this very, I would say, paradise-y feel to it.
Yeah.
Right. And that's it. That's the end of the chapter 19. It really wasn't too much of story heavy. It was just basically going up the Crystal Tower and getting through it. That's it.
Rain's kind of disconnected the whole chapter because she's like, she's worried about what's going to happen. But
yeah, she feels weird about something.
Yeah. You do. By the time you get to the top and get to the gate, and then it's like, okay, now you got to go down to these other places and get to defeat these four elemental fiends. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I don't know. It was like, whatever. Why are we doing this? None of this even matters.
Did you get Titan here?
No. Dude, I've not done any side quests. Like, what level are you?
I couldn't tell you offhand.
I'm in the 40s.
I might be in early 50s. I'm not exactly sure.
And your playtime is like double mine, by the way.
So the secret area here, if you defeat like all the Kuza beasts, which are those yellow behemoths, you can like get the gimme things for the bottom floor of the tower. And Titan is there.
Oh, cool.
And then the four boss elemental bosses that makes you fight, they're Asterius, Bure, Kraken, and Tiamat. So, but you can't catch them.
Oh, darn.
This dungeon's fucking long.
Yes.
Corey, by the time we were finished with it, like I said, Corey was like done. He didn't want to play anymore. Anyway, so this brings us to the final chapter of our segment. Chapter 20, The Crimson Prophecy's End, which, like I said before, is basically just a huge cutscene dump. The plot is revealed here, finally, in the 11th hour. So they're at this, like, paradise-y location. They're at this, it's this big, beautiful-looking, like, portal called the Ultima Gate. And apparently Rain, like, faintly remembers being here before. So at this point, Brandalus shows up, and he is, we've seen him in like one or two scenes early on in the game and haven't seen him since, but he's the main villain, and I do like his design. He looks very intimidating, but you know, he's the leader of the Bahamutian Federation. Makes him sound like he's the leader for charity.
You don't know, he might do stuff in the spare time,
but apparently he's also an ancient evil, like he's the demon king or whatever that fought their mother forever ago. This part, another one of the funniest moments is here to me. You know how like every time you meet a character, it does like a freeze frame and their name appears on the screen at the bottom right? Like anytime you meet a Final Fantasy character or...
Yeah.
It's like their little character introduction screen. So Brandalus gets his little character introduction screen here. He's the main villain. And I'm like, we're in chapter 20 out of 21. We're getting our villain intro here.
Great storytelling.
Yeah. So you have a boss fight with him. Any trouble with him?
No.
Yeah.
I just rolled through him.
Yeah. Went
too. I had some of those items that were like the heavily damaged things that do 3,000 a pop. Like I just chucked like 10 at him and he was dead.
I did appreciate, well, he didn't have any elemental weaknesses. So
no.
You couldn't just like exploit that for a win, easy win.
Well, each time I used one, it was 3,000 hit. Yep. So I was like, let's do this.
So the masked woman, who's that knight-looking lady in white who we've seen a few times, she appears and tells them that they have to open the gate to free their mother, Luce Farna, who is in like this cube that's hovering above them. It kind of looks like a Prismarium, sort of. So they do free her, but apparently this is exactly what Brandalus wanted. And so the four summoners are like embedded into this gate in like the corners of it. So you got Yuna, Rydia, Aiko, and Terra in there. And so the Federation is using the gate and the power of the summoners to bring back all these evil, like ancient demon monsters called the Cogna. And so the person that was in Luce Farna's Prismarium turns out to be Alwyn, who is the masked woman. And she is, Lawrence and Rain's sister. There's like a flashback where Rain remembers talking to Alwyn as a kid. So Alwyn is pissed at them because apparently Lawrence and Rain have done this exact same thing in the past, like played right into the villain's hands and opened the gate to release the Cogna.
I'm going to bet you this is Lan's fault the first
Probably.
Because he's stupid.
So all hope seems lost for a minute here. And then Tidus appears and he rescues Yuna. And then Squall and Cloud and Lightning also show up and like save the day. Like they like rescue the twins and Alwyn and the other summoners, as you know, all hell breaks loose behind them. So because they rescued the summoners, apparently like not all the Cogna were able to get through, but it was still a lot of them. So then you wake up at the League of S's headquarters, which turns out to be Balam Garden, which I thought was really cool.
Yes.
Or rather, would have been really cool, but it really only lets you explore like the front lobby area and then that little balcony, that the air deck or whatever from 8. I wish they had expanded this place more. I thought that would have been really awesome. So stop me if I'm forgetting bits and pieces here, Rich, but it was pretty late when I played through this. but a lot of dialogue happens. Grimoire is in chaos, and apparently like all the towns that had like submitted to the Federation before are like fully corrupted and subjugated. They're like evil monster towns now. Mm-hmm. The ones that resisted are still fighting back. And I think this next chapter is going to begin with us like going to each of those towns to help them.
I think so. There's a lot of monsters that you see that are kind of familiar. I think I saw some weapons.
Oh, I didn't like really pay attention too much to them, but
one of them looked like Ruby weapon in some aspect of it from 14. Huh. I don't know. It had some similarities to it. There were some of them that looked at some, you know, the Ruby weapons, Emerald, things like that. And correct me if I'm wrong. I might, somebody listening might know that, but yeah, I could have sworn there's some big players that just dropped in.
Yeah. Also Quistus and Shelk are here as members of the League of S, and they're just used as like exposition to explain what's going on. Kind of, you do go back to Ninewood Hills at one point and you kind of like meet up with Tama and Seraphie. And Seraphie gets a lot of dialogue here compared to how much she's had so far. But they're just explaining like how bad the Cogna are. And Rain brings up that maybe this was part of Inna Crow's plan all along. But Tama is just like not willing to believe that. It would suck if God was against us. Is this game going to end with us fighting God?
I almost bet you that's what's going to happen. We're going to fight her. And she's going to be like, I am the one. I was totally pulling all the strings.
Maybe.
It's Final Fantasy. It's probably going to happen. And then some mysterious super god's going to show up going, I am the thing's father or mother, whatever. So,
also like the throwaway line of Quistus's here where they're talking about how Alan is in the infirmary, and they even mentioned Dr. Kadawaki from Final Fantasy VIII, who's like kind of a minor character, even in 8, but I was like, is Dr. Kadawaki going to be one of the Final Fantasy characters? Of course, that doesn't happen, unfortunately.
Nope.
Eventually, they do get the chance to talk to Alan, who's still pissed at them, and they have like a little back and forth conversation, and Alan decides that apparently the Federation does have Luce Varna, their mother, and so she's going to go and save her herself. So Alan just sort of like flies away. I'm like, wish we could fly.
Yeah, she had, what was it, Siren?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Basically, Quistus gives the twins an airship and asks them to go around and help fight the Cogna. And that's how this chapter ends. Like I said, big-ass plot dump here at the end here. Any thoughts on this chapter that we haven't already gone over?
No, I mean, it was nice to see like a lot more heat pop up all of a sudden, a little more urgency, and the story kind of unfolded right there, as opposed to like, you know, a couple chapters earlier where it could have been like, hey, there's a gate. This is what's happening. The Empire is going to do this. Not like all of a sudden, but holy crap, this is everything. So,
it's also funny that the Empire or the Federation or whatever has apparently been planning for like 100 years to how to manipulate the twins that are doing this.
Yeah.
But okay, we're running a little long for this segment, so let's go ahead and jump into the feedback. Frost says, so you went around collecting keys, no one really tried to stop you, had absolutely no idea what was going on, and unlocked a super portal thing. Who could have imagined you were doing the bad guy's bidding the whole time? Gee, I wonder. You didn't think we'd get through a Final Fantasy game without some weird-ass JRPG shit happening. Were the Cogna really necessary? I guess, I mean, if it wasn't the Cogna, like, what else would the portal have been? Like, they had to have had a plan to do something. So I don't know.
We had no idea what a portal, the whole thing. We had no idea what this was going on.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
Enjoyed the Tidus laugh and Shintoto's appearance, which we agree with. Not sure what the Quacho Queen is. Me either. The Tomberry King fight was more annoying than it should have been. I don't carry a Lightning Mirage in my stack, so I ended up using Electro Marbles and such. I looked ahead to see like what the bosses were going to be weak to and shit.
Cheater.
Corey said, Corey ended up spending like 15 minutes several times in each chapter, just completely redoing the stacks, which took forever. That's one reason it took us so long to get through this section. Frost goes on to say, Terrace fight should have been the last indication that you were doing the wrong thing. I love that these bad guys have been setting this whole thing up for 100 years. Sorry to say, but chapter 18 is the last fun chapter. We're in total Kingdom Hearts mode now. There's so much going on, but the truth will finally be revealed. Next time. Also, Vampire Prime Mirage is OP. Still haven't touched the side content. 18 hours of play. Hopefully I'll have enough to get through to the end. I'm at like 46 or something.
I'm at 23. Jesus.
Maybe I'll get the plat. Who knows? I heard that some of the post-game content is tough as nails though, so
I ain't doing that. You know that. All right, so ROB, this person ROB states that so close to the end and still so much coming. Yeah, we know. It was a great seeing the cameos reappear and affect the story more.
I did like that. I did like how, you know, Tidus and Lightning and all them came back and actually had a hand in how the plot played out, I guess.
It's all right. Try not to spoil too much. Tonberry King was my first death in the game, which continues a proud tradition of Tonberry's killing me in FF games for as long as I can remember. Also, this is my first water world in the game that didn't irk me, but probably because it played like any other level.
Yep.
We know the bad guy's plans now, and while nothing crazy, typical RPG story beats, there are a few twists revealed, but as Frost said, we're in Kingdom Hearts mode now. Oh, also, Balamgard, hell yeah. I just wish there's more to explore more of it. Also, Gilgamesh is by far the funniest part of the game. He got him in my party, too, at the end. His last move is great. When it hits, you can get him.
He must mean the champion jewel.
Oh, okay. I was like, I didn't know that you could get him. Anyways, I think
he could either as a mirage, anyway.
Yeah,
it could be. Well, I don't find Gilgamesh that funny in this game, so I don't really get that. Oh well. Brandon says, my concise thought: too bad this story wasn't told at all before now. Okay, so there's that.
Yes.
J.S. says, I didn't do a single bit of side stuff until I finished this section. I didn't even realize how the summoned mirages work because I didn't have any. He must be talking about the XL mirages. I have some. I've never used them.
I don't even know how to use them. I've got one.
I think you have to put them in your stack or maybe just in your party. But then there's like there's a command that you can just, it's like summon or something.
Oh, I have it.
I've heard they're not great internet. Though. Okay. I realized after the fact that summoning one would have made that Tonberry King fight easier. A summon could have taken that massive attack. Instead, I beat it by killing it before he could unleash it and taking out the other Tonberries after. The Crystal Tower was long and not in an interesting way. All those spiral staircases just artificially padded the time it took to climb. On the side quest stuff, I went wild and done a ton of intervention quests. I accidentally realized some of these quests were part of advancing the story in the next section. I realized this when Seraphie showed up and started dumping story exposition after I finished one. Oops. The highlight of the side quest so far have been... this next one's a spoiler, so I'm not going to read that. There is a fun intervention quest with Snow and Gilgamesh, which I have done that one, and it's just Snow and Gilgamesh being total idiots and not understanding each other.
Spoiler alert. I have not done any of that.
Yeah.
All right, Colin. This is our last feedback we have. Colin states, it is the greatest game of all creation. I'm pretty sure he's lying out of his ass. We were talking about Ligeia, right?
Yes. Apparently Colin loves Ligeia as much as you do.
Yes. Instant best friend. Duffy, not Saga?
Yeah, he followed it up. I thought Saga was the best game of all time.
Yeah, no, Duffy, go away.
Yeah, but that's all it for the feedback. Overall, I would say it was a fine segment as far as this game goes. I did like getting a bunch of story, even if it was at the 11th hour. But still not in love with this game. I think it's a good game. I'm not going to like bash it when it comes to the review more than it deserves. But I get why maybe this is a less liked Final Fantasy game. Like how you never hear a whole lot of good stuff about this game necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you said, this chapter segment's it's been the entire time. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like I said, I'm not going to destroy it on the review. I am going to destroy it on some parts, but, you know, there's some good aspects to it. So
Frost did say that 18 is the last fun chapter, so I don't expect 21 to redeem it much. So, but yeah, I guess that's it for this club. So a quick reminder, the next goal for the RPG club is to beat the game, finish chapter 21. And that is due by, Sunday, May 23rd is when.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then a week after that, we'll start nominations for the next one. So anybody who is not already a patron, this is your chance to help influence what game gets selected. I'm so excited.
Yes.
Hopefully it's one, not that I've hated this game, but I hope it's one that everybody as a whole can enjoy a little more.
This is your game that you picked.
I know. I have no regrets because I sort of consider this like a main Final Fantasy game, kind of, more or less. Yeah. So I wanted to have it under my belt regardless. But yeah.
I mean, get it done at least. I mean, we could say that we played it.
Right.
So
Well, shall we adjourn the club for now, Rich?
Let's do this.
We're going to let Rich go and bring Corey back in here.
Bye.
We're back. I've dumped Rich. I brought Corey back in for the outro.
I'm back.
That's going to be it for part one of the Valkyria Chronicles 4 review. So, Corey, do you want to tell the people what we're doing next week?
But the next episode that we're going to be doing is going to be, no surprise, part two to the Valkyria Chronicles 4.
Okay. And then Realness wants to know when the Metal Gear Solid 3 review is for the patrons. We will
We
finished the Valkyria Chronicles 4 because that'll be a bonus review. Corey didn't want to do two reviews in one weekend. So
probably the second weekend of June, right around.
Sometime. We'll get there. as far as the RPG Club, one more reminder. We are playing World of Final Fantasy, and the new due date is to the new checkpoint is to complete the game. Beat it by Sunday, May 23rd. I is excited. Launching into our plugs here.
So first off, if you have not already, please jump over to whatever app that you listen to this podcast from and give these guys a rate and a review. It really helps kind of promote the channel, helps other people find the channel. But yeah, that's one of the best ways you can help the guys out. Give them a good 5 stars and put in a couple nice sentences for them. And then for the Patreon, some of the benefits you get are early episode access. I think you get the episodes 2 days sooner than everybody else. You don't have to listen to ads. Anyway. You what?
When it's me editing anyway.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to listen to the ads anymore. It's just straight up all the talk and chit chat goodness. You get the aftercast, which is where the guys just kind of more casual conversation about more maybe controversial topics or things that usually wouldn't be covered on the regular show. So it's more of a get to know the guys kind of thing, and they can be a little more loose-lipped. And then you get a bunch of extra reviews because as of right now, there's over 20 basically full episodes that people don't get unless they're a patron. I'm on a bunch of those, so go give some money and listen to them. You get to participate in the RPG Club, which is you get to nominate a game at a certain tier. You get to nominate a game, and then you get to vote on which game the RPG Club's going to play. And that's just some of them. There's many more. So head on over to patreon.com/RPG After Years to sign up now.
And that RPG Club nomination and voting, that's going to be happening like towards the end of this month. So
sweet.
Yeah.
I got to be thinking about what game I want.
Yeah, me too. So we also stream these episodes live to Twitch. So if you want to watch these episodes, you can do so by going to twitch.tv/RPG After Years. If you're wanting to know our schedule, you can pay attention to our Twitter or hop into our Discord. We usually record them Sundays at 9 a.m. Eastern. But when it's just me and Corey like this, we usually do those on Saturdays at noon. So just keep an eye out.
And then also they have a merch store. It's on Redbubble. So write this down. This is a little bit of a longer one, but if you don't go to this exact website, you won't be able to see all the options of merchandise. But it's redbubble.com/people/RPG After Years/explore.
You can get all kinds of neato mosquito shit.
Speaking of which.
Yes, Corey is wearing a black RPG After Years V-neck right now.
Yep. Super soft, super comfortable.
They really are. So if you want to reach out to the show, you can do so by emailing us at rpgafteryears@gmail.com. You can give us episode ideas, give some feedback. If you don't want to leave a review, just have some questions. That's one way to reach out to us.
You can also join our Discord, which is usually popping off. There's a bunch of cool people in there, always talking about different topics. But you can find that link in the show notes, or it is the pinned tweet on the Twitter account.
Speaking of Twitter, you can find us. The show account is at RPG Years. And if you want to find me, I'm at the Scott Spot.
And I'm at VFL Corey.
Awesome. So I guess we can go ahead and start closing things out here. That's going to be it for episode 64. Join us next week as we continue this review in episode 65. But until then, I'm Scott.
And I'm Corey.
Squad RP Gay, move out.
I love that it's RP Gay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.